And we're back on Fictional Frontiers. I'm your host, Sohei Bawan. Each week here on Fictional Frontiers, we cover the best in pop culture entertainment. Quote unquote. It's all subjective, right? Whether it's film, television, video games, you name it. And as we wrap up the season, I want to talk about a couple things. I want to talk about the Critics' Choice nominations. Obviously, I was part of that process. And I'll walk through some of those things and some of my thoughts about the process and also the nominees as a whole. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the elements related to just the genre industry as a whole, where we are, where we're going into 2024. Our old colleague, our old compatriot, James Berardinelli, the founder of RealViews.net, the best online film critic in America. We might hear from him next week as we go into the new year. And then obviously we'll be doing our regular segments from then forward. But in the interim, I thought I'd give my take, and then next week I'll give James the opportunity to kind of run with it, and we can go back and forth on quite a few things. But the Critics' Choice Association nominees or nominations came out last week. And I'll walk through the list here and some of my critiques and some of my perspectives on not just the award season, but the nominees themselves. So probably helps to start with, I don't want to say the bottom up, so to speak, but just, you know, some of the categories that people somewhat pay attention to, but not really that much time is paid to them as far as the masses are concerned. You've got best score. You've got best song. You've got best animated feature. Actually, I'll stop there. I want to talk about the best animated feature for a moment. The nominees, according to the Critics' Choice, are The Boy and the Heron, Elemental, Nimona, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, and Wish. And it's very interesting because it's a mix of CG-heavy films or CGI-heavy films. You've got some Disney. You've got a big Disney presence there. So you've got some Disney stalwarts there. And you've got Spider-Verse, which again, pushed the genre forward or the medium forward in ways we haven't seen before. And I would hazard a guess that probably it's going to come down to The Boy and the Heron and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And it's really difficult from a critical perspective to compare the two films from an animation perspective or a storytelling perspective, because it really comes down to preferences. It comes down to stylistic choices. You look at Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, it is a frenetic, heavy, action-centric project with a blend of so many different animation styles. So many different artists came to the forefront on that particular project. And it really is overwhelming in many ways and very impressive on a technical level. From a storytelling perspective, there are elements in there that really resonate strongly with audiences, not just here, but overseas. And yet you have a film like The Boy and the Heron, which is a film from Miyazaki Sensei, Hayao Miyazaki, his supposed last film. It seems like he's going to be doing another one. And it's more of a traditional, quote-unquote, animated film. And it harkens back to a bygone era of animation. There are obviously CGI-related elements in there, but they're so subtly placed in the film, you'd have to really have a sense of what those elements are, how that process works to understand, you know, how they've been incorporated. Otherwise, you'll miss it, so to speak. And the reason I highlight those two films, and I feel like they're the two favorites, is because it's old school versus new school, so to speak. The future versus the past in many respects. And I don't know if that's maybe the fairest way to kind of position things, but the reality of the situation is that when it comes down to the list of categories or list of films here, I mean, there's probably going to be some love for the Ninja Turtles film as well and some of the other projects too, because, you know, they do have their respective audiences and fan bases, so to speak. But I think it's going to come down to the two leaders here. Two projects that really reflect, like I said, the incredible history of animation from the past that's still, you know, like the veteran chugging along, and it's the future. And it's kind of akin to what we saw in professional tennis with Novak Djokovic versus Carlos Alcaraz. Novak Djokovic, the veteran, the player that has been setting the pace for so many years versus Carlos Alcaraz, the up-and-coming whippersnapper, the number one at that time when they were playing for most of the season. He was number one for most of the year, going back and forth. And at the end of the year, Novak Djokovic emerged the winner, and I feel that's going to be the same here, to be honest with you. I would not be surprised to see Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse win, but the boy in the heron, I think, is going to eke out a win because it is another demonstration of the veterans showing up, the old heads representing, and I think that's a big thing here. So, you know, sometimes when you look at nominations, you get this sense that, okay, it's just a been there, done there approach to things. But once in a while, like this category, you do see some really interesting dynamics that in a way reflect what the industry as a whole is going through. And I think that's what's going to come down to, or what it's going to come down to, I should say. Because I do feel to a huge extent that these films are a product of voices from different generations. Hayao Miyazaki, the Disney of Japan, been around for decades and decades. The Spider-Verse crew, who just won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature for the previous Spider-Verse film, pushing the envelope again. And so it'll be really interesting to see which way they go. I think that The Boy and the Heron will eke out a win. However, it would not surprise me if Spider-Verse won, because there are quite a few younger members of the Academy who may not be as enthralled with the traditional approach to things, and they really want to reward something that hasn't been done before, and that's the Spider-Verse film. Then you've got some other categories like Best Visual Effects, and this is the thing that was really interesting to me, and it kind of serves as a nice segue between the animation discussion we just had and what the future of animation is going to look like, and that's the Best Visual Effects category, because you have The Creator, you have Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Why Poor Things is there, I have no idea. Okay, I'll just push that off to the side. There's so many visual effects heavy films here and overseas. And you can just even look at Godzilla Minus 1 as an example. And they put Poor Things there. And I think, again, sometimes what happens with the critical masses, so to speak, they just kind of go with the flow for whatever reason, okay? Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, though, an animated film being included in the Best Visual Effects category. I've never seen that before. At least I don't remember ever seeing that before. And again, it shows that animation itself is changing, because just like the Lion King film many years back, I remember John Campy had mentioned this, that the Lion King film was actually not a live-action film. It was an animated feature. There's a blurring of the lines of what is and what isn't animation, what are visual effects, what's live-action. I think when AI comes into the mix, it's going to be even more complicated, especially when you're not going to be able to discern what's quote-unquote real and what's not real, what's an actual image of something that's there versus something that's rendered, via these massive, massive AI early in the morning here. Maybe I'm saying IE because it's like IE, you know, I don't want to say that, but the AI behemoths, maybe that's part of the issue, you know, that basically here what we're seeing is that AI, you know, it's crazy how things are going to be changing in the next year or two. My friends keep sending me links to AI produced content and say, pick the real picture out from, or the real image out from the four. And what you find is that all four images, if there are four of them or five of them, six, whatever, they're all AI generated. Some are more, I guess you could say, immersive and tend to fool you more easily than others, but nonetheless, they're all there. Got off on a huge tangent there, and it was definitely an IE moment, or, you know, it's definitely not IE with AI, I guess. That's my poor attempt at humor here to make up for my stumbling there for a moment. You've got Best Cinematography, you've got Maestro, Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, Poor Things, Saltburn, and Oppenheimer. What I saw consistently with the nominations is that you see the front runners in one category tend to be the front runners in all the categories. It's very interesting. And I don't know why that happens. As a member of the Critics' Choice Association, we're sent screeners of so many films, you know, foreign language films. We get films from A24 and other independent houses. You get the big blockbusters. And this is where subjectivity comes into play, but also what happens among critics, I do believe, and I try to avoid that to the best of my abilities, is the herd mentality, where you basically just become so engrossed with a particular project, you feel like it needs to be rewarded across all the different categories. When in reality, if you look at each individual category, you come to the understanding very quickly that there is superior work in other films that may not be superior in other ways that should lend credence to the notion that that film, instead of the film that is getting all the momentum or having all the momentum, they should not be included in that category. So a film like Poor Things, okay, cinematography-wise, I can almost guarantee that there are films, at least, again, from my subjective perspective, that are much better from a cinematography or a cinematic perspective than Poor Things. And as far as the film itself, full confession here, when I found out what the film was about, I said, I'm not going to watch this film. There's tremendously problematic content and subject matters being addressed in this film. And I feel like, again, it's, you know, sometimes people are impressed by the notion of extremes. And when odd, perverted deviation or deviance comes into play, masquerading as art, people buy into it because they feel like, if I don't recognize this, then I am not someone who appreciates the finer things from a creative perspective. It's why you see things in New York, for example, at, you know, some of the art galleries with respect to some of the pieces there. Some of the art that's on display in modern art houses is not, by most people's accounts or perspectives or views, art. It's perversion of art. And again, we can go back and forth on what art is and what it should be. You know, art is a means of expression of what's on the inside coming out, so to speak. But typically, if you look at the history of art throughout all the different nations and periods of time in our collective history, you will find that again and again and again, there is this connection to something primordial in the human being, which appreciates beauty so strongly that they cannot deny that this is the epitome of expression of what's good and whole and what should be expressed or celebrated. If you go and visit the Grand Canyon, I have never seen, unless someone's gone through a traumatic experience, obviously, involving falling or heights or what have you, I have never seen anyone say that the Grand Canyon is not majestic. It's not awe-inspiring. It doesn't remind you of the miracles of creation when you see a place like the Grand Canyon. That, at its heart, is about the full manifestation of beauty. And art that reflects that, or art that celebrates that, or art that is in the same vein or vibes with that notion, is the type of art that has been produced for over 1,000 years. It's only in the last, you know, 200 or 300 years that we've, for whatever reason, and, you know, I'll go off on a tangent another time about why that may be the case. Maybe we've lost that connection with the human soul that we should have and our true humanity. And so, rather than tap into the beautiful aspects of the human experience, we ignore that and produce content or produce art that is absent all of those important qualities. Maybe that's part of it. But in the last 200 or 300 years, there's been a real switch to or embrace of art that deviates from what is considered to be beautiful or worthy of adoration or respect or honor. And I do feel a film like Pretty Things is in that category. I feel that what it is deviant understandings or leanings or absence of the essence of humanity masquerading as a commentary on the beautiful things we all find in humanity, or we should celebrate in humanity. Those questions we might have, those experiences we want to cherish. And whenever there's a project like that with quote-unquote A-list talent involved with it, there's this reflex reaction among critics to celebrate a project like that. Again, like I said, because they don't want to be left out of the astute elite critics category. You know, they want to be considered to be in the know, to be knowledgeable, to be above the fray. And so they have to embrace the odd and the eccentric. But at the same time, and there have been, you know, examples of pieces of modern art which are just disgusting in their nature by most people's perspectives, that people, and maybe it's the intent of the filmmakers to try to curry favor by doing this, by pushing the envelope, saying, oh yeah, you know, it means this, it's this, this, this. There are lots of other ways to talk about or to express or to tackle or to address core questions and issues of humanity other than the most ugly and the most deviant and the most perverse. And I feel like the pretty thing, or poor things, I keep saying pretty things, it's poor things, excuse me. Poor things is in that vein. And every year, that's another reason why, and that's in discussion for another day, we see so much of mainstream embrace of art films or Academy-centric films or award-centric films, we see a rejection of those films by the masses because they have not lost a connection with the essence of what it means to be human because they don't have the luxury of doing so. When you're working 9-to-5 jobs, when you are dealing with hyperinflation, when you're dealing with your, you know, children getting to school on time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you don't have time to focus on anything but what it means to be human because you're living it. You're living the human experience. And you know what's beautiful because the beautiful things are the things that we all find beautiful. When our child excels in a particular class or in a sporting endeavor, when, you know, someone we care about, again, going back to children, always goes back to children. We see them at a piano recital. You know, those are the kinds of things that remind you of what it means to be human, what's important in our humanity. But when you're separated from that and you're distracted by so many other things because the basic essential elements of the human experience are no longer at the at the forefront or the focus because, hey, everything's taken care of. I got enough money. I can just hire a nanny, whatever, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You tend to focus on other things. You lose that connection with what it means to be human and the beautiful things of the human experience. And so when you try to express that humanity, it comes out very ugly. And so Poor Things, Not Pretty Things, I feel is a perfect case study of that phenomenon. Well, that was a huge digression there. Well, let's quickly go through some of the other categories. Here you got original screenplay, best director. Best director is going to be an interesting category because you've got, you know, Bradley Cooper for Maestro, Greta Gerwig for Barbie. You've got Yorgos Lanthimos, the quote-unquote director of Poor Things. You've got Christopher Nolan with Oppenheimer. You've got Alexander Payne, The Holdovers, and you have Martin Scorsese, Killers of the Flower Moon. I think it's going to come down to Christopher Nolan and Martin Scorsese. And I think Christopher Nolan's going to win this because he's been knocking at the door for so many years. He's probably the only filmmaker today of the new generation, quote unquote. If you want to put Cameron there, you could, but a lot of his stuff I feel is derivative and it's more about the technical side of things that he is a master of. And he doesn't produce enough content. You know, one film every 10 years is not really that much. But if you look at someone who's consistently been creating, developing, producing stories, telling stories that we have not seen before, it's Christopher Nolan. And they will want to reward him, I feel, for his work. So I think, that Oppenheimer is the shoe-in for Best Director. And when it comes to acting ensemble, you have Air, Barbie, The Color Purple, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, and Oppenheimer. I think it's going to come down to probably Oppenheimer and Barbie and probably Killers of the Flower Moon. And it's a toss-up there. It really is a toss-up there. I think it's really going to probably split a lot of different ways. And ultimately, in the end, it could be any of those three films. I don't think The Color Purple, The Holdovers, or Air have a shot. Although Air was a very interesting film that I actually was not surprised to see in this category, because it does have quite the ensemble cast. When you look at, you know, the acting categories, again, there's always politics and there's always rewarding those over time that comes into play. If you look at supporting actress, you have Emily Blunt for Oppenheimer, Danielle Brooks for The Color Purple, America Ferrera for Barbie, Jodie Foster for Naiad, Julianne Moore for May December, and Devine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers. The favorite so far is Devine Joy Randolph. I thought she did an exceptional job in The Holdovers. So I think that she could be the favorite here. But I think it's going to come down to her and, I believe, Emily Blunt for Oppenheimer. Again, Emily Blunt, an actress who's been doing superlative work for many a year. And people like to reward people who have been doing this for quite some time. And that's the same with Robert Downey Jr. in the supporting actor category. When you look at the nominees there, you've got, you know, Robert Downey Jr., you've got Ryan Gosling, you've got Charles Melton, you've got Mark Ruffalo, you've got Sterling Brown. I think Robert Downey Jr. is the overwhelming favorite. He's much loved in the industry. He's an exceptional actor. He's excellent in Oppenheimer. I think he's going to win that. I don't want to say running away, but I think he's pretty much the runaway winner, unless there's, you know, some love for Robert De Niro. Again, exceptional in Killers of the Flower Moon, maybe wanting to give him one more bite of the apple, so to speak. Then you've got, Best Actress. Lily Gladstone, I think, is the favorite for Best Actress in Killers of the Flower Moon. I think she deserves it. If I look at the other actors in the category, some people are saying it's Emma Stone. Again, I don't think, I think the more understated performances are the ones that impress me the most, because they convey the reality of humanity. And if you look at some of these some of these nominees here, to some extent, I think, I'm focusing on Emma Stone primarily. Again, it's when you have a frenetic, over-the-top performance and you add an element of shocking acts of, either violence or sexuality, you always get extra points for that with the Academy or the voters. I don't know why. Again, I think there's this misplaced rewarding of taking risks, quote unquote, or putting yourself out there, putting yourself in a position that's uncomfortable. There's this misplaced notion of putting yourself in an uncomfortable position with being or performing in a way that's exceptional. Being odd or strange or doing something that's, somewhat off the beaten track. I would even go as far as saying let's just say more something that require. Let's just say that intimacy brought forward when it should be kept private. I'll put it that way. When there are those elements in the mix, people in the Academy or these organizations always give extra points for that. I don't know why. It is problematic on many levels, but it is what it is. And that leads me to Best Picture, actually. I've kind of been bouncing around everywhere. It's, heading towards the holiday break for many, so I wanted to tackle as much as possible. And we'll probably talk about some of these things. And I know James will push back, against some of these things as well. But you've got American Fiction, Barbie, The Color Purple, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and Saltburn. I would probably vote for, I'm showing my cards, but I think it's going to. And when I look at a film like Oppenheimer, if you ask me, okay, would you vote for Oppenheimer? I would say I would consider strongly Oppenheimer, but not the version I saw here in the United States. I would consider the international version only. Why do I say that? Because there are a couple scenes in Oppenheimer which have, in my opinion, gratuitous nudity, completely unnecessary. It adds nothing. I don't believe nudity adds anything to any film. I think you can convey those intimate details and interactions in, you know, 100 different ways, if not more, without showing everything. You don't need to show to tell. I've mentioned this before. Life is Beautiful does a wonderful job of talking about or expressing intimacy between a man and a woman without showing anything. And you get everything as clear as day in the scenes that follow some of their interactions. And when I mean their interactions, the lead actor and actress. What's happened now in modern times is show, not tell. And again, going back to the Poor Things critique, there's this notion that showing the intimate, which should remain intimate and actually takes away from the intimate, is something that should be championed or braved. And it's actually something that takes away the specialness of something. It actually takes away the shock and awe that comes from violence. If you show a lot of violence, you're going to be desensitized to violence. That's definitely the case here. If you show, you know, these scenes of intimacy, what ultimately happens oftentimes is that those actual moments of intimacy, not just on the screen, but off the screen, become less special because there's nothing that's considered to be private. It's not special any longer. And so Oppenheimer, they had a couple scenes in there, but they had released a version of the film with Christopher Nolan's approval that was shown in other parts of the world that had CGI use technology, or they use CGI to actually cover up some of the nudity. And no one knew about it. There are people overseas who did not even realize that that had happened. And so if you ask me whether I would vote for a film like Oppenheimer, which I feel was of these films the most technically, most narratively impressive film, I would only vote for that film if I had the option to vote for the film as or with that version being at the forefront. If that's on the ballot, the international version, I'm voting for that. You're listening to Fictional Frontiers. Enjoy the weeks off. I guess you might have a week and a half off, and we'll be back hopefully next week with James Baranelli. But, you know, over the top discussion, or a discussion that went many directions, but a worthwhile discussion nonetheless. If you have any questions, send us your notes and thoughts, and we'll catch up with you next week. Talk soon.